All right, first question. What are your top supplements for reducing inflammation markers? So inflammation, it is considered one of the main root causes of, you know, virtually all chronic diseases, including aging itself. Like that, there's the term called inflammaging, which refers to the age-associated increase in inflammation in the body. So, you know, not all inflammation is bad. You do benefit from some amounts of inflammation, especially when we're talking about fighting infections like a fever. You also need inflammation for muscle hypertrophy. So the, you know, cell swelling response is an inflammatory response. And if you shut down or blunt that inflammatory response with cold exposure or too many anti-inflammatory supplements after resistance training, then you also blunt some of the beneficial adaptations. These adaptations are from exercise. So not all inflammation is bad. The problem is that, you know, the amount of inflammation is what's bad. So in the modern world, or if you have certain, let's say, comorbidities or chronic diseases, then you might experience too much inflammation, chronic inflammation, which is one of the main hallmarks of aging as well. Chronic inflammation, which contributes to inflammaging, age associated increase in inflammation, and the subsequent increase in the chronic diseases as well. So, you know, generally the healthy lifestyle is going to reduce your inflammation as well. Getting enough sleep, eating like a proper diet, not overeating calories. Like any food in excess can cause inflammation. So it comes down to like just energy balance and maintaining optimal body weight. But in the question of what are the certain supplements, then, you know, there are quite a wide variety of supplements that can have beneficial effects on inflammation, such as, you know, glycine and NAC. They increase glutathione, which has anti-inflammatory properties. I've talked a lot about that on the channel as well. In certain situations, magnesium can have anti-inflammatory effects. Then there's things like, you know, vitamin C, vitamin E, those are antioxidants. Astaxanthin has anti-inflammatory properties. Even like ginger and stuff like quercetin, fisetin, apigenin, you know, they generally have some anti-inflammatory properties. Is the effect size very big from something like quercetin or fisetin? I don't think so. There's not a lot of like studies looking at that. But I think, you know, the most powerful and most like bang for your buck in terms of the anti-inflammatory effects are omega-3 supplements and melatonin, glycine and NAC, and curcumin. So I think those would be the top five like legitimate antioxidant or anti-inflammatory supplements that I would, you know, consider. Like vitamin C, yes, it has certain anti-inflammatory properties, but it's not, you know, as powerful as something like melatonin, for example. So, you know, taking omega-3s every day is a good idea to increase your omega-3 index, which is associated with reduced risk of heart disease and mortality and Alzheimer's even. So that's a good idea to like just keep in your routine on a daily basis. Second of all, melatonin, every once in a while, microdosing melatonin is also good for not only the sleep properties, but also the anti-inflammatory, antioxidant properties. So melatonin, in my opinion, is like a very powerful longevity hormone. And with age, you see a decrease in melatonin levels. Then second of all, glycine and NAC as well. I've talked many times, glycine is a staple in my daily diet, and NAC is something I take on and off, not every day. You don't want to take NAC after a workout because it can blunt some of the positive adaptations. Same with curcumin, and you know, same with some other anti-inflammatory supplements. You don't want to take those after a workout, but you can take things like, you know, omega-3s, melatonin before bed, omega-3s you can take like before meals, for example, to increase the absorption. And curcumin is better to take, yeah, like on the rest days or before a workout. Next question, did you share yet to complete what to eat for optimal living? So I haven't like, yeah, really outlined in detail my what I think is the optimal diet for longevity, first and foremost. And I think the answer depends a lot on the particular individual. And, you know, the reason I haven't done this video before is because I'm more of like an agnostic when it comes to diet and nutrition. You know, I've done many different types of diets, and I've seen, you know, many people doing different diets and getting great results with that. And when you look at centenarians, the people who live over 100 years old, then those people also have a pretty wide range of different diets. And there's also some like not healthy components in their diets. So a lot of the centenarians, they might, you know, eat ice cream, they might eat chocolate, they might eat, you know, some other, like some cookies or something like that. So the centenarians, again, you know, they're not the perfect like role model for regular people, because the reason why most centenarians live to 100 years old is because of their genetics. Let's be honest about that. Like, they smoke, they drink, those kind of things. So they just have a very favorable genetic profile that like protects them against those kind of unhealthier lifestyle habits. So I think that the diet, the reason why we want to focus on the diet in the first place is because a particular diet is going to help you to achieve a particular biomarker profile. So, you know, it has to include, because the biomarkers at the end of the day are what matter more than the diet. Of course, there are some diets that help you to achieve the better biomarkers much easier and faster than other diets, and, you know, even better results with some diets and some foods. But the biomarkers are, at the end of the day, what matter the most. So, you know, some of having like the optimal blood markers for things like your fasting blood sugar, hemoglobin A1C, fasting insulin, lipids, inflammation markers, immune cells, sex hormones, liver enzymes, kidney function, all those things are what matter at the end of the day. So you can, theoretically, you can achieve that with almost like any diet. There are certain principles that like are kind of a must or like very correlated with those beneficial outcomes, but at the end of the day, that's what matters. So you can achieve that with a pretty wide range of different diets. And what makes a particular food unhealthy, which means like not fitting that profile, or healthy, which means that it helps you to achieve that profile, is determined by, you know, many other factors besides the food, like the total energy quantity, so how many calories you're eating, how is your body composition. Those things also affect the biomarkers. So the diet is just like a means to an end of having these, perfect is a big word, but just having good biomarkers that are associated with longevity and reduced risk of chronic diseases. So you just want to fit into, okay, I want to have my biomarkers fit in this pattern that are associated with the lowest risk of diabetes, heart disease, and those other kind of chronic diseases that most people die to. So I think, you know, then you can try to reverse engineer your way to those biomarkers. So, you know, there's certain principles in the diet, like, you know, try to eat 80% whole foods. You don't need to be some sort of a very perfect clean diet, because like I said, there are many other factors that can affect those results. So if you are someone who is very fit and exercises regularly, then you have a lot more wiggle room, if that makes sense. You can get a lot, you can get away with a lot more than someone who is completely sedentary and doesn't exercise at all, because they have a much worse metabolic health. Like, exercise is the most powerful thing for your metabolic health, like hands down. It can literally pretty much make up for a bad diet in the short term quite easily. Of course, in the long term, you do want to have a relatively healthy diet, but it just goes to show that there are so many more important things than just a diet, and that you can achieve longevity with a wide range of different diets. So, you know, when you look at Okinawans or Japanese people, they have, and Koreans, they have a very high life expectancy. Both of them have over 80 years of life expectancy, which, you know, is much higher than in the US, for example. But they have a very different diet from the Mediterranean region, which also has a pretty high life expectancy. So that clearly shows that there are some genetic factors that can determine how healthy a diet is for you. And there's just, you know, many things that can contribute to the final result, and many different diets that can achieve that. So I'm just more of like an agnostic in terms of that. I don't care really what kind of a diet you follow. I don't care overall what kind of a diet you follow. Like, you can choose whatever diet you follow, but for me at least, I don't care whatever diet it is. I'm just interested in the biomarkers, and I'm like reverse engineering my way from the biomarkers, because those are much more important in my opinion, and is much, you know, like, the nutritional studies are hard to do. There's a lot of confounding variables. With the biomarkers, there's a bit more certainty, I guess. Like, you know, you can make much better conclusions from the biomarkers than from the diets, I think. So with that out of the way, what I think are some of the like key principles for a healthy diet. So first off, the most important thing is energy balance. So you don't want to become overweight and obese, because whatever diet you follow, if you become too heavy, if you have too much body fat, then it's going to have a negative effect on your biomarkers, and eventually down the line it's going to shorten your life expectancy as well and have negative effect on your longevity. So energy balance is kind of king in the sense. And how do you know if you're in energy balance? Just looking at your body fat and how much you weigh. The body mass index isn't a good, reliable measure, but the body fat percentage generally is slightly like a better one. And depends on how you measure your body fat percentage. You know, the DEXA scan is like the gold standard, the most accurate way to do that. But with the DEXA scan, the ranges can be somewhat different from when you're using it like with the calipers, for example. But, you know, for men, the average or the kind of optimal body fat percentage would be something around like 10 to 12%. For women, 15 to 20%. Women can get away with a lot more than men, in the sense that women can be even overweight and still make it to centenarianhood, probably because of their hormonal profile is different. Whereas men, there's no unhealthy centenarian men. Like all the men who become centenarians have had to be very healthy throughout their entire or most of their life. Like, you know, 90% of centenarians are women, and the 10% men who reach 100 years of age, those men, they don't have any, they have very little, they're in much better health than the centenarian women because of their, like the women, the kind of the cardioprotective effects of estrogen, for example, apparently is one of the reasons why the women live on average like 5 to 8 years longer than men, and also like why they're able to reach old age in not a perfect health. But if you're a man, then you really have to be, you know, be in optimal body composition and optimal biomarkers if you want to reach the age of 100. That's kind of based on the data of just how many, how little or how few centenarian men there is, actually. Second of all, not only that the body fat percentage matters, but also the amount of muscle mass is relatively important. So people who have slightly higher muscle mass have a longer life expectancy, or they have a reduced risk of mortality, especially the older you get. If you're somewhere in your 20s, 30s, 40s, then it doesn't matter that much how much muscle you have. Like, you know, you might be at a risk of obesity if you have too little muscle or some other like diabetes or metabolic syndrome. But the importance of muscle really starts to show after the age of like 65, because there your age-related muscle decline starts to catch up with the person. So if you have too little muscle, then you can break a hip and you're at a risk of sarcopenia and frailty. So people who have sarcopenia, low muscle mass, they have a high, 100% higher risk of mortality compared to people who have normal or higher amounts of muscle mass. So muscle mass is important to maintain, and you want to like, you know, be ahead of the curve in your youth. When you're in your 20s, 30s and 40s, then you want to have, you know, slightly higher muscle mass while still maintaining lower body fat percentage and maintaining like, let's say, lower waist to hip ratio and lower waist circumference, because that's a reflection of lower amounts of visceral fat. If you have very high waist, then it means you have this visceral fat around the organs, which is much worse than the regular type of fat under the skin. So yeah, like, you know, just having muscle obviously isn't the answer. You also want to have lower body fat percentage and lower waist circumference to ensure that you're not just accumulating mass. Just so being like super bulky and super heavy and just having a bunch of muscle mass like a powerlifter or the strongman, that's not healthy in the long term. So you still want to maintain relative leanness. So how do you achieve the higher amounts of muscle mass? You know, protein is by far the most important macronutrient for that. You know, the single biggest predictor of muscle mass is resistance training, but eating enough protein is also quite important. So, you know, aiming for somewhere around 0.8 grams per pound of body weight is what peaks. It's the maximum threshold for muscle growth from protein intake. So, and that's like 1.6 grams per kilogram of body weight. You don't need more than that. Like in the past, a lot of people have said like 1 gram per pound of body weight. You know, it doesn't matter if you eat more than that, then you just don't build more muscle, but you don't have any other negative side effects either. Like you're just wasting that protein for energy, but you don't need any more than 0.8 grams of pound per pound of body weight, actually. So that's what I aim for. I'm getting around 130 grams of protein per day, which for me is, yeah, like the 0.8 grams per pound of body weight. And the rest of the macros and foods will just, you know, fit there. Like looking at your body composition, making sure that you get enough of the protein, and making sure that you don't gain extra body fat. That's kind of the most important part to longevity. And of course, kind of trying to get at least 80% of the food as whole foods is good. If you have a few, like if you have some, let's say, processed foods in the diet, it's not going to break the bank, if that makes sense, as long as your biomarkers are optimal. So, you know, what matters with unhealthy foods is also the amounts. So I tweeted this a few weeks ago. So this hypothetical scenario, you know, if you eat one potato chip every day for the rest of your life, it's not going to have like literally no effect on your longevity. Like if you just eat one potato chip every day for the rest of your life, your inflammation markers aren't going to change, your blood sugar, your lipids aren't going to change, everything else. It's just such a small amount that it has literally no effect on your biomarkers. I'm not saying that you have to do it, but I'm just giving this a hypothetical scenario. But if you eat 100 potato chips every day for the rest of your life, then that's a very high likelihood that you're going to gain weight, and you're also going to accumulate, you know, the visceral fat. You're also going to have worse lipids, your worse inflammation markers. So yes, in that scenario, the 100 potato chips will have a negative effect on your life expectancy. So it all depends on the dose and the amounts of what you eat. And the same, you can apply the same thinking to healthy foods. Let's take one egg. If you eat one egg every day for the rest of life, it's going to have virtually no effect on your biomarkers and your longevity. If you eat 100 eggs every day for the rest of your life, you probably will have, you know, it's just a lot of calories and you might have like some, let's say, worse biomarkers as a result of that, and you might accumulate just a bit too much body fat. So any food in excess can be harmful, so you need to figure out what's the amounts of that food I can eat and how it affects my biomarkers. So if you eat like 60% of your diet as ultra-processed food like the average American does, then it's very likely, you know, it's highly likely that your biomarkers are going to be messed up, you're going to be overweight. But if your diet is only 10% ultra-processed food, 5%, you know, 20% I think is the kind of limit, it should generally be below 20%, because after that 20% is, you know, I would suspect most people will start to see their biomarkers go worse and they start to gain weight. But if 5% of your calories come from ultra-processed food, then it's very unlikely that it's going to have any like significant effect on your biomarkers. You might have a few things off in terms of the what's the optimal range, but then you just course correct accordingly. Okay, you measure your biomarkers. Okay, oops, I'm eating too much this type of food apparently because of my biomarkers. I'm going to reduce it. Okay, the biomarkers go back to normal, and vice versa with the healthy foods. Okay, I'm not eating enough of this because of my low amounts of muscle mass or something like that. I'm not eating enough protein, for example. So the biomarkers, I think what I'm trying to say is like matter at the end of the day. It's like that's the North Star that you want to look at. And then the diet itself is just, you know, okay, the anchoring point or the means to an end of having these clean biomarkers. Everyone's always asking me, what do I put into my protein shake? I'll tell you exactly what. It's 30 grams of whey protein, 10 grams of collagen, and 1 teaspoon of raw cacao. I blend it up with water and ice cubes, and it becomes incredibly creamy. Whey protein is the most bioavailable protein source in the world. Many studies have found that whey protein supplementation improves muscle growth and strength when combined with resistance training. Whey protein stimulates muscle protein synthesis 31% more than soy protein and 132% more than casein after resistance training. Whey protein also promotes glutathione production, which is the body's main antioxidant that supports immunity. The brand of whey protein I use, Nordcode, has pure organic whey from grass-fed cows from the Alps. It's the highest quality and cleanest whey protein in the world. I combine it with a Nordcode Complete Collagen that has added glycine, which is beneficial for joints and skin health. Nordcode also has organic raw cacao with lion's mane and chaga extracts, which improves cardiovascular health and energy. All of this for only 250 calories, over 30 grams grams of protein to maximize protein synthesis, and 10 grams of collagen for skin anti-aging benefits. If you're allergic to dairy, then Nordcoat also has plant-based protein powder made from pea, hemp seed, and rice protein with added MCTs and maca. You can get a 10% discount by using the code SEAM10 at livehealthy.com/collections/Nordcoat. Next question, too much fruits gives you diabetes. So this is a pretty interesting question. Like, you know, I think over the past 10 years or so, this idea that fruit is bad for you somehow has become quite popular, or it's become quite common among certain groups of diet people. And what is the truth? Well, when you look at the outcome data in humans, then fruit consumption isn't associated with diabetes or heart disease or mortality. It's actually the opposite. People who eat, you know, 5 servings of fruits and vegetables, they have a lower risk of diabetes and lower risk of mortality as well. So just the claim that too much fruit or too much fructose gives you diabetes, fructose from whole fruit in this context, that's just not true when you look at the actual data. Like, there are some like mechanistic reasons why people think that fructose is harmful for you. Like, it's going to fill up your liver glycogen stores. Your liver is going to overspill fat. You're going to accumulate visceral fat. You're going to have worse biomarkers. And also the claim that, you know, these modern fruits are just cultivated sugar bombs. It's going to spike your blood sugar very high. Well, if you look at the data of actual humans eating fruit, then that's not the case. Like, it just falls flat on its face in that sense. Is there, like I said, previous question, too much of anything can be bad. If you eat 100 apples a day, then probably you have high triglycerides. You might have a bit more visceral fat. You might have digestive discomfort from eating 100 apples per day. You might have a slightly higher blood sugar as well because of the high triglycerides. But it's not obviously like a realistic scenario. Like, most people don't eat 100 bananas or 100 apples per day. Is it like eating 2 pieces of apples or 2 apples and 2 bananas a day or something like that? Is it going to give you diabetes? Obviously not. The like studies indicate the opposite, that people who eat more fruit generally have less diabetes or lower risk of diabetes. So you need to find out, okay, how does your blood sugar respond to whatever food are you eating? So the mechanism by which fructose from fruit could increase the risk of diabetes would be that, like I mentioned earlier, you eat too much fructose, the fructose fills up your liver glycogen, the liver starts to overspill, you have an increased level of triglycerides in the blood. Triglycerides are these fatty acids in the bloodstream that inhibit insulin production by the pancreas, which then causes this mild insulin resistance, and your blood sugar levels stay elevated for longer. What's worse than that is eating processed food. So processed food is, you know, does like exactly that. It raises your triglycerides, it lowers your insulin sensitivity, it increases your visceral fat accumulation. So processed food is, you know, it's that on steroids. For regular fruit to cause that response, yes, you would need to eat like 20, 30 pieces of fruit every day. So regular fruit, even if it's this modern cultivated, higher sugar content fruit, that's not going to do it. And you also need to look at the general context. So fruit has lower calories, it's more satiating than fruit juices or some other regular candy. So it's not going to increase your risk of diabetes just in of itself. Even like the worst, even just Coca-Cola, regular sugared Coca-Cola, even that isn't going to increase your risk of diabetes just in of itself. Like, it also matters in the context. If you're drinking the Coke, are you also overeating other calories? Are you also sedentary? You know, it depends a lot on the person. Or like, in the majority of cases, then fruit isn't going to increase the risk of diabetes. And when you look at the actual outcome data, then it does the opposite. People who eat fruit generally have lower risk of diabetes, as long as you're not eating fruit on top of the ultra processed diet, you know. And then even then, it's the ultra processed food that generally increases the risk, not the fruit, if that makes sense. Next question, please suggest the best form of collagen to consume for maximum health benefits. So when you look at the studies, then the type of collagen that is shown to reverse the hallmarks of skin aging and also improve cardiometabolic risk factors, then it's collagen peptides. So collagen peptides are different from gelatin powder. They're different from regular collagen powder, And they're also different from like other protein powders. So the peptide form is what has been shown to give those results. So you, if you want to be accurate and specific, then it's the collagen peptides, low molecular weight collagen peptides. So because of their unique structure and bioavailability and size is what has been shown to give those results. Next question, does glycine cause high glucose spikes? Also, why it's not promoted widely as sugar substitute for its sweet taste and all the benefits? So first question is, does glycine cause sugar spikes? No, glycine actually lowers your blood sugar response. So 3 grams of glycine can lower the blood sugar response by up to 30%. And the reason it does it is because it raises insulin. But in this context, obviously, insulin is very beneficial because it helps to lower the blood sugar. And insulin has gotten a pretty bad reputation over the last, you know, again, 10 years or so. But insulin itself isn't bad. Insulin is what actually helps you to lower the blood sugar response. So insulin itself isn't like a problem. It's actually even some studies, people who produce the most robust insulin response to an oral glucose challenge, those people have the lowest risk of diabetes after in a few years follow-up. So actually producing a lot of insulin in response to a glucose challenge or eating some carbohydrates is actually a good thing because it means your body is insulin sensitive. Your pancreas is producing enough insulin and that helps to lower your blood sugar. If your body doesn't produce the insulin, that's a sign of insulin resistance and not being glucose tolerant enough. So I think many people just focus on the insulin. I'm afraid of spiking my insulin. Well, the much worse scenario is not producing insulin, if that makes sense. And the glycine does raise insulin, which then lowers the blood sugar response as well. And of course, glycine has all many other health benefits, glutathione, collagen synthesis, creatine synthesis, anti-inflammatory, and stuff like that, which I've talked many times. And the second part of the question is, why isn't it recommended as a sugar substitute? I guess it's a bit more expensive than stuff like stevia or sucralose or monk fruit or whatever your type of sweetener is. It's a little bit more expensive, but it's certainly, in my opinion, a lot healthier than most of the other artificial sweeteners out there. And, you know, like I've said in some of my videos, I'm aiming for at least 10 grams of glycine per day as a supplement. So I'm, pretty deliberately adding it to like teas, coffees, into my yogurt or stuff like that. So I'm using it as a sugar substitute quite a lot. Next question, quinoa spinach, good for muscle or increasing testosterone because of high ecdysterone? So ecdysterone, it's this insect steroid hormone, which is used as a supplement. It's said to have muscle growth benefits. It's similar to like the turkesterone, which has been popular for a few years. And the ecdysterone is like a form of that. It's kind of this insect steroid. And you get it from some foods as well, such as spinach, quinoa, buckwheat, and some other like vegetable foods. Now, is eating those foods going to give you enough of the ecdysterone to have an effect? Probably not. You would need to like consume, too much, let's put it that way. Like you would need to consume several kilograms of those foods to get any meaningful amount of the ecdysterone. And even then, the research about the ecdysterone having muscle growth benefits is also somewhat limited. With turkesterone, the kind of main consensus is that it doesn't provide any like additional benefits compared to even like creatine or something like that. It's not better than creatine. And the same applies to ecdysterone. I think there's not any evidence that it would support muscle growth. I have used turkesterone and ecdysterone myself in the past, at least based from my own placebo experience. Turkesterone did help with strength, not the muscle mass, but strength. It certainly helped with, like, I was a little bit stronger when I was taking turkesterone. And the same with ecdysterone as well. Like, the strength did increase slightly, but, that was like 5-6% increase. But it didn't improve my muscle mass. So yeah, like your, spinach and quinoa, they're fine to eat, but you're not really getting a sufficient amount of ecdysterone from those foods. And there's also like another compound, phosphatidic acid, that increases mTOR expression. And mTOR is the main master switch for muscle growth. You also get phosphatidic acid from cabbage. But, to eat how much cabbage you would need to eat to reach any meaningful amount of that phosphatidic acid, then it's going to be like, you know, 20, 25 kilograms of cabbage or something like that. You know, it's a good, healthy food to eat. Like sauerkraut is amazing. Different kinds of salads or these fermented dishes with cabbage is great. You know, it's a healthy food. But yeah, like trying to get ecdysterone or phosphatidic acid from those foods, that shouldn't be like the main reason you eat them because it's going to be, let's say, futile to try to get any meaningful amounts from them. Next question. Matt Walker said in the guest series on Huberman podcast about sleep that it's rather individual how long before bed one should stop eating. How general can the advice be given? One should stop eating X hours before bed. What's your take on this? I do think that there's a lot of individuality in this. So I feel better if I stop eating, you know, 4 hours before bed. I've tried, you know, eating 2 hours before bed as well. I sleep worse because I eat like a larger dinner, so having too much food in my stomach 2 hours before bed does reduce my sleep quality. And if I stop eating at least 4 hours before bed, then I sleep better. Some people might feel better if they stop eating like 8 to 10 hours before bed. You know, that's fine. I think you would get deeper sleep, honestly speaking, because your stomach is empty and you're in now like a semi-fast state. You go into this deep sleep a bit faster, I think, I would presume, because of spending less time on digestion. Whereas if you eat like an hour before bed, a very large meal, you might feel fine, but your body is still digesting a lot of the food, so you might not get that deep of a sleep. So, but you know, again, it depends on the person and how do they feel. And, you know, of course, tracking it with a sleep tracker like the O-Ring or some other monitor so that you can see, okay, how much deep sleep or REM sleep am I getting? What I've noticed is that I'm getting deep sleep fine even if I eat late, but my REM sleep is lower if I eat too late. So that's what I've just noticed. You want ideally to get both REM and deep sleep in sufficient amounts. So you just need to, yeah, like experiment. Generally, I think a good rule of thumb is to stop eating at least, you know, 4 hours before bed, but some people get too hungry. So if that's so, then just have a smaller snack, some cottage cheese or yogurt with some berries. That's a nice low glycemic, high protein, satiating snack that doesn't fill you up too much, but it also has, you know, the protein and calcium and those kind of things that help with the sleep stages as well. So yeah, just kind of experiment a little bit. Next question, do you have any tips on how to offset caffeine effects if I accidentally drink it during nighttime and having trouble sleeping? So yeah, caffeine has a pretty long half-life. It's like 5.8 or 5.6 hours, something like that, like almost 6 hours, the half-life. So, you know, if you drink caffeine at 12 p.m., then 50% of it's still going to be in your system at 6 p.m. So that's a big, you know, reason why caffeine has a negative effect on your sleep. If you drink it any time in the afternoon, then it can have, let's say, it's going to reduce your sleep quality even if you don't notice it. So it's going to be about like 10% reduced sleep quality on average, even if you drink it relatively early. So is there a way to offset that? Yes. So if you have this genetic, if you're genetically a fast metabolizer of caffeine, then those individuals can get away with eating or consuming caffeine pretty late. Like I'm a fast metabolizer. I can drink coffee even for dinner at 6 p.m. and then I'll still be able to fall asleep. It might be a bit worse quality, but I'll be still able to fall asleep. Whereas some people, the slow metabolizers, if they drink coffee even at 10 a.m., they might notice a hard time falling asleep in the evening. So first of all, know your caffeine metabolism. And second of all, there are certain foods that help to clear out caffeine faster. So vitamin C is a good one for that. And the carotenoids as well. So like carrots, tubers, those kind of things help with clearing out caffeine. So in the evening, I usually, what I've done recently, because I've been writing a book, I've been like consuming a bit more caffeine than usual. So over the past, you know, 6 months or so, I've been just caffeinating a little bit more than previously. So what I've done is just eaten like an orange after dinner. So the vitamin C in the orange, it makes me a bit more sleepy. And the vitamin C pretty much helps to clear out the caffeine faster. And like I said, the carrots, tubers, they can have the same effect. So this is one hack you can try in the evening if you're feeling a bit like wired up or too energetic. That can do it. But second of all, you need to build your sleep drive or sleep pressure. So this is the feeling that you want to fall asleep. So if you're super tired, you've been up 24 hours, then you feel the sleep pressure is pretty heavy. Like you can just lay down and fall asleep almost anywhere. So how do you increase the sleep pressure and sleep drive? Physical exercise and activity, sunlight exposure, and food intake at appropriate times as well. So the more physical activity you do, the greater your sleep pressure is. So doing a workout during the daytime is going to be very beneficial for sleep. Like the studies find that the more you exercise, the better sleep quality it is, pretty much. And the same way with vitamin D and sunlight exposure. If you're exposed to a lot of natural sunlight during the day, that also increases sleep pressure and sleep demand. And it also helps you to produce melatonin in the evening. So getting a lot of, ideal scenario is even if you drink coffee in the morning or in the noon, just go outside, do a workout, and even taking a sauna or something, that's also going to make you more tired. And that's going to help you to pretty much increase your sleep pressure and clear out the caffeine from your bloodstream faster. Next question, what do you think of a T-score of 2.1? And if low, how can I increment that number? So the T-score is used to reflect your bone density. If you do a DEXA scan, then they're going to scan you and give you a T-score and a Z-score. They're pretty very similar, but pretty much a higher T or Z-score means that your bone density is, a few standard deviations above normal. So having a T or Z-score of 0 is like normal for your age group, plus 1 is 1 standard deviation above normal, plus 2 standard deviations above normal, minus 1 is, below standard deviation, minus 2. So that's minus 2 is going to be some of the range of the osteopenia and osteoporosis. So the lower the number in the minuses, the worse, the higher, the better. So 2.1 is excellent. So it's 2 standard deviations above normal for your age group. I also measured my bone density in November. For the T-score, I got 2.9 in my spine and the Z-score was 3.0, which is, 3 standard deviations above normal for my age group of 29-year-olds. So as you can see, it's pretty maxed out in terms of the bone density for my age group, and the score, the bone density is going to decrease with age on average. So if you stay 3 or 2 standard deviations above normal all throughout your life, then you have a pretty good high bone density. I measured my hips as well, so my hips are less dense, if that makes sense, and the score for this was 0.5 for T and Z score. So I'm only 0.5 standard deviations above normal, which is still, great. Like it's, 0.5 standard deviations above normal, but it's not as high as my spine, obviously. And I think the reason for that might be because I'm overloading my spine with almost like every exercise that I do. Like I do a lot of, even if I do squats, my spine gets a lot of stimulation from the heavier weights. The deadlifts train the spine. Even the bench press can train the spine to a certain extent, and pull-ups and all those things train the spine or like stimulate bone density in those. Whereas with the hip bones, the femur, then that only gets trained when I'm doing squats. Obviously, I train squats pretty regularly, but I'm going to like change some of the way I do it. I'm going to try to squat a lot deeper. I'm going to try to train like these ass to grass squats, pretty much of going full depth, and with heavier loads I'm gonna have to reduce the weights, but I'm gonna just go deeper just to hit the femur bones a lot more. And the mechanical tension and mechanical overload is the biggest determinant of bone density. Of course, you need adequate protein intake as well, and calcium and magnesium and vitamin D, etc., but the resistance training is the biggest contributor to bone density and increasing the T and Z score. So yeah, I'm going to keep doing obviously the heavy loads on the spine, but I'm going to change my squats to the very deep kind of ass to grass form of squats with heavier loads. And I'll see if that's going to increase my hip bone density as well. Next question, a lot of quality meat, fish are packed in plastics. Is this a problem? So recently I talked about a study where they looked at the commercial proteins sold in supermarkets. They looked at fish, meats, these Beyond Burgers and those things as well. And they found that virtually all of them had microplastics in them. So even the regular red meat, regular fish, unprocessed fish and those kind of things, they all had microplastics in them. And the authors of the study concluded that the Americans are consuming millions of microplastics from protein alone per year. So this is obviously worrisome, especially in light of the another recent study where they found that the microplastics accumulated in the arterial plaque of people. So I think this goes to show how prevalent microplastics are in our lives. You know, is it, I mean, you can't really avoid all of them, even if you, yeah, like not drink from plastic bottles, you don't use any microplastic containing skincare or those kind of things, even then you might get the microplastics from the protein that you eat, and you obviously need protein to live. So, you know, what I'm thinking about is that you just minimize your exposure to microplastics from everywhere else where you can. Don't drink from plastic bottles. Don't use the plastic Tupperware. Get the glass kind of containers. Get glass bottles and those kind of things. You know, try to not use any these regular skincare products that have microplastics and those kind of things. So it's a pretty, let's say, very hard task to avoid them completely, because even then, like, you're gonna get exposed in some shape or form. Should you be worried about the protein side? You know, like I said, you can't avoid protein. You need protein to live. It's like the only macronutrient needed for survival. You can, yes, like go to the butcher directly and get like your pieces of meat from there, or if you have a fisherman, get the fish fresh from them, from the net, like that. And some of the other, let's say, packaged proteins generally contain some microplastics. And, you know, even like you can, if you have like the actual dry beans, so the dry beans in some sort of a container, like because if it's dry, then it doesn't leach the microplastics. So if the product is wet, so like meat is moist if it's inside a plastic container, so that's why it leaches into the product. So if the container is, or if the product is dry, like dry beans or dry legumes or whatever, then it doesn't have any microplastics. And the same with like the meat, if it's wrapped in paper or something like that, then it shouldn't have the microplastics either. Next question, is vitamin A equal to cod liver oil? So cod liver oil contains vitamin A. You know, it's hard to say if it's equal to that, because, you know, I don't know what it means, if that makes sense. Like, you know, you can get vitamin A from quite a few different foods: liver, cod liver oil, sweet potatoes, carrots, so to say. So is it equal to cod liver oil? Well, you get a lot of other things from cod liver oil as well, some omega-3s and some other vitamins, vitamin D as well. So it's a good source. It's like, I think it's a pretty good source of omega-3s and vitamin A and vitamin D. And I think vitamin A supplements otherwise aren't like a good idea. It's better to get the vitamin A from food, such as cod liver oil. But you have to be kind of double checking the source of the cod liver oil. And like liver is also high in vitamin A, and other foods like carrots and potatoes. They have like the plant form, which isn't as bioavailable, but it's, you know, carotenoids themselves are individually associated with lower risk of mortality, lower rates of neurodegeneration, lower rates of cardiovascular disease. So the carotenoids you get from sweet potatoes, carrots, and some other, this squash and salmon and those kind of things, those are associated with better health as well. So you want to eat those anyway, in my opinion. All right, that's it for this Q&A. Make sure to click a like, subscribe, notification bell as well. My name is Seem. Stay optimized, stay empowered.